You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
It's Thursday, 9th of July. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you loud and recorded from my apartment in Bromfontein Vat. On the show today, Alex Dace talking markets, storming ahead, rand and gold, Justin Schmidt from ABSA unlocking the constraints in manufacturing, and Dr. Petrus de Kock from Brand SA managing brands during a lockdown. The show is proudly sponsored by FMI, a division of Bidvest Life Limited. Make your impact, protect your income first. The views and opinions expressed in this show do not reflect the views and opinions of FMI. Some morning headlines from MoneyWeb. Total will continue with its exploration in offshore South Africa. And from Business Day, Steinhoff to sell Conforama France for a nominal sum. Morning markets, we got green across the US, S&P up 0.8%, NASDAQ up 1.4%, Asia also green, Sydney up 0.9%, Tokyo up 0.6%, commodities, oil slightly red, gold at 18.20, the rand at 18.94, and top 40 calling for about a 0.4% green open.
MoneyWeb Now. On the money.
I'm chatting with Alex Dace. He's head of equities at Mthombo Wealth. Alex, morning. Appreciate your time. An announcement yesterday, in one part insignificant, in another not. Steinhoff to sell their Conforama France for a nominal sum. That's their phrase, not mine. Means probably a couple of cents. This is a business they paid 1.2 billion euros for in 2009. Steinhoff is technically bankrupt. It's a punter's penny stock, but it kind of does almost bring it full circle from those heydays of sort of the latter part of the first decade to what is now a stock with a few assets, but mostly a lot of legal claims against it.
Yeah. Good morning, Simon. Yes, so Conforama unfortunately doesn't have any value, as you correctly say. There's predominantly trying to get rid of the liabilities. Now, ironically, when they initially bought Conforama, and it, let's say the 2-3 years that followed after that, it was hailed as a massive success. Mm-hmm. You know, and looking back now, obviously the fraud and so forth really papered over the cracks and the likes. But yeah, certainly a big disaster. And yeah, I can't see any equity value, to be quite frank, in Steinhoff. The litigation damages claims is just ginormous, and the value of the assets, sure, I don't know. For me, if you're still invested in there, I think it's probably to get out, to be honest.
You've got a lot more courage than me if you're still invested in that stock. I want to touch with gold. I don't know how much you look at gold. I was digging around. Since the lows of March, gold's up some 20%. It's trading at 18.20 an ounce. We've got the ZAR around 17. I mean, the gold miners, obviously, that leverage impact has done phenomenally well. If we're looking at a you know, we see a disconnect between Wall Street and Main Street. We've touched on that before. Is gold an option here, or maybe gold miners for investors who are looking for something that perhaps there's a little bit of a less disconnect? It makes sense that in a pandemic, gold should be rising.
Yes, so it's the first time probably in my career that I'm quite bullish on gold, and there's a few reasons for that. So firstly, we've had unprecedented monetary but as well fiscal stimulus at the moment, so and we haven't really recovered even since the global financial crisis, so yeah. There was no normalization since then. Things have deteriorated, and I think specifically debt has really spiraled out of control, and perhaps even the risk of deflation is on the cards now due to the fact that economies have come to a standstill. But the reserve banks will not allow that. So you can see more stimulus, anything it takes to prevent deflation. And that really boosts the argument for gold. Because gold is really a hedge for unexpected inflation in future. No one is anticipating that. But if it does come through, gold will certainly be the one that's going to help you. I'm not saying you should go gung-ho and so forth, but it's certainly, I think, healthy to have some exposure in a diversified portfolio.
Yeah, I got to say, I'm with you. First time in my career where suddenly I'm looking at gold and it's like, hey, look at this. To me, it was always, you buy a gold mine to close a short. That was it. Are you looking at the yellow metal or perhaps a local or maybe an offshore gold miner? Which would be a preferred entry into it?
So that's a difficult one, because if you do believe gold is going to rally and let's say argument be above $2,000 on average next year, the real benefit is going to come from the stocks. They're much more geared, as you said before. So for your South African investor, there's obviously a few options that you can consider. The one that's probably going to be the highest geared locally will be DRD Gold and Harmony, because predominantly SA businesses that is geared. And then, but if your risk appetite is not really there, then you should simply just buy the gold ETF. But the returns will probably be a lot more muted. I mean, probably if you're right, make 10, 20, 30%. And if a gold counters, if you're right, you can easily make double or triple your money.
Yeah, I suppose a good point there. It really is about a sort of a risk assessment in many senses. The other one I wanted to touch on is the rand. It's been fairly volatile the last couple of days. 20-cent moves, truthfully, that's kind of on par for the rand, but it's floating around that 17 to the dollar level. When you guys at when you're looking at investments, how much do you take a view into the rand into account, or do you really sort of almost in a sense park the rand and just delve into the actual business that you're looking to invest in?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, it's almost impossible to really predict what's going to happen in the rand in the short term. There's just so many variables at play, and most of those variables are really outside the control of SA as well. So it's not like we can look just at South African domestic fundamental factors and then come to the conclusion that the rand's constrained from a weekend. Predominantly, whatever happens to the dollar will happen to us, and there is so many variables affecting the dollar. But what you can do is you can see the structural weaknesses in the currencies, so over the medium to long term. So, for example, since even the 1970s, the rand depreciated around about 6 or 7%, even since 94. The pace has accelerated a little bit the last decade or so, but you can certainly pencil in that the rand will continue to weaken over the medium term. But there will certainly be periods of rand strength, which could even be a year or so. Who knows? It's difficult to say. But certainly, we try to position predominantly for medium to long-term rand weakness. But also, if you do buy foreign investments, rather value those assets in its local currencies, as you're trying to get too clever and trying to time the currencies in your local in rands.
Yeah, that's a good point. If you're investing offshore, look at that currency you're investing in, kind of try and ignore the currency, which in some ways is easier, some ways harder said than done. Alex Dace, he's head of equities and Mthombo Wealth. Really appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
Chatting with Justin Schmidt, he's head of manufacturing sector, Absa Retail and Business Bank. We chatted a couple of weeks ago, I think it was, when we had some of the manufacturing data that came out. Justin said we need to do a follow-up. We didn't have enough time back then. Justin, appreciate your time today. Really what you're looking around here is unlocking constraints that exist within manufacturing, and there are loads of them. We can touch on some of them, but usually in an ideal world, your problems are finding customers and squeezing margins. In South African manufacturing, your constraints are much wider and often out of your remit, out of your hands.
Yeah, so I think we touched on it quickly last week, but things like regulation, lack of infrastructure spend, demand from consumers, those are all things that manufacturers have been feeling pressure from. And we saw this week that consumer confidence hit a 35-year low. So I think the pressure continues. But we know that a lot of that's related to the lockdown and the pressure that we're feeling because of that. Interestingly, though, for manufacturers, one of those constraints was lockdowns, because they couldn't work in lockdown, essentially, because there was only a certain percentage of labor force that could work at that stage. And what we have seen in level three versus level five, our estimate is about 80 to 90% of the sector activity is permitted in level three versus the 50 to 60% in level five. So that already is one constraint that's out of the way. I think, regulatory, we're seeing the government understands that, we need to support the industry. So we have seen a need for one infrastructure spend to start again. That'll be key for the sector. And then things like master plans, those are key, where we've seen the success of the automotive master plan and the success of that industry. And we know things like the textiles industry have got a master plan that's in its draft form and hopefully signed off by all players. And then the agro-processing sector and agriculture sector, we're seeing master plans being developed there. So I think that'll unlock a lot of these constraints as well.
Yeah, and I imagine, I mean, tourism is one that also springs to mind for master plan. And a master plan, if I'm understanding correctly, I mean, the automotive sector, it was around some tax breaks. It was around, you know, even just the port in Durban, just to get the cars onto the seas and to the other countries, sort of creating an environment where it's conducive and where manufacturers want to manufacture.
Yeah, 100%. So if you're going to invest to that point, you know, if they want to manufacture, then they'll invest and they'll come to the banks to lend for that capex expenditure. And certainty is key. So I think even these master plans, what they give is we don't want over-regulation, but sometimes unclear regulation mm-hmm. also is just as bad. We saw it in the energy sector where, you know, there were new regulations not signed off, but it created uncertainty. What we've got now is a lot more certainty. And I think if it's clear, and it gives an indication of where we want to go, that's important. What we did see, for example, in the automotive sector is that some of those clients weren't getting load shed while the rest of the economy was feeling that. So sometimes you can get lucky and even, you know, to that flip side where it's an important sector for the economy, sometimes these other constraints that the rest of the economy is feeling, you know, they don't see the effects just as much. So that's where these master plans really are important. The tax breaks, like you say, so there are special economic zones where there's reduced tax mm-hmm, levels. Mm-hmm. There's the export opportunities. And it's not just our master plans. Things like AGOA offer opportunities for export, the Africa Free Trade Agreement. So I think all of these things start lining up. And we just need to get through this time. And I think if everything comes together, hopefully we can get a lot of support from manufacturers and kickstart them.
You mentioned load shedding. I mean, one of the big issues for manufacturing has been the load shedding. And, you know, and again, if you knew it was definitely going to be between X and Y, you can work around it. It's not great, but you can. But is this a space? I mean, does industry wait for Eskom, or does industry take the cost and look at off-grid solutions to sort of secure their businesses?
Oh, so I think 2 years ago, we would have said no. We were seeing pockets of, you know, off-grid solutions, but it was more kind of a green agenda and international companies saying, well, we want this office to, you know, to be fully green and compliant with, you know, the Kyoto protocols back then and now the Paris Climate Accord. So it's the green agenda, right? But what we're seeing now is that companies are saying, well, one, I have to look at the cost increases, you know, from the NERSA and ESCOM mm-hmm. process where we're seeing double digit again, and there's uncertainty of how high it will go. And electricity becomes more and more a cost component of that expense line and a higher proportion of that expense line. Then number two, what we're seeing a lot of clients are saying in the manufacturing sector, as well as across other industries, saying, well, when I am load shed, I don't have that certainty, but also if I lose that production, I lose that revenue. You know, some manufacturers can't stop that production line. So there's another knock-on effect where, you know, the certainty would be important for them, but because it's uncertain, they lose production. So that now is being factored in, and people are saying, one, how much does it cost me to run a generator? And two, how much does that lost production cost me? And then they're coming back and say, well, actually, I'd like to look at going off-grid, or at least a portion of it, so I can run when the grid's off, I can run key components of my production line off-grid. So it's definitely something we've seen a lot more of, and something that we have been getting applications for, and it's something we view favorably with clients.
Yeah. A last question is buying local. And that's more than just, you know, me and you being conscious when we're at the grocery store and picking a local olive oil as opposed to an imported. But it can be broader. It's manufacturing customers sort of buying from their fellow manufacturing rather than perhaps looking offshore. You know, it sounds silly in a sense, but it can gather momentum. It can surely become significant at a point.
Yeah, and I think we've recently seen the Proudly South Africa campaign mm-hmm. Being launched again with the adverts, and it is looking at one what happened to the supply chains through lockdown, and we did see, you know, the dependence on certain markets for goods. So we saw two impacts there. One, you couldn't get your supply of goods when they were disrupted. And two, we were seeing shortages. So prices were impacted. So I think that's put into people's mind. You know, do we protect our supply chain and move it closer to home is the one point. And maybe we should spend a little bit more to have that certainty of localization. And I think the other is, you know, with this textiles master plan, for example, why don't retailers buy from a local textile manufacturer, for example, and create a more sustainable industry, because that creates jobs. It's got all these multiplier effects. And I think if all of us have that conscious kind of buying habit and look at proudly South Africa, it's not just feeling good about buying something that's from South Africa. It's got these knock-on effects, and it's got employment impacts, and it supports the industry as a whole. So I definitely think from a buying local perspective, it has all those multiplier effects, and it will grow the industry, and it's more important than just buying that one good. It just supports local manufacturers and the employment of, you know, South Africans.
We'll leave that there, Justin Smith. He's head of a manufacturing sector, Absa Retail and Business Bank. Justin, appreciate your time and insights.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
I'm chatting with Dr. Petrus de Kock. He's a general manager for research at Brand South Africa. Yesterday, they released their brand finance rank, looking at top South African brands. And we're looking at values of brands. Petrus, appreciate your time. I suppose let's kick off with, and I imagine it's technical, but how are you determining, Borgli, a value for a brand?
I think the brand finance methodology is incredibly comprehensive, ultimately, when one looks at that. It looks at things like your revenue, it looks at your appeal to your customer, it looks at customer satisfaction. So there's a number of factors that they work into that. So I think in terms of the methodology, is also underlined, you know, by an approach that says you must be able to quantify, you know, anything from your customer experience perception, mm-hmm. all the way through to shareholder value and the impact it has. So it spans quite a few dimensions there.
MTN, Vodacom, FNB, Absa remain the top four. Mm-hmm. Old Mutual sneaking into position five. Yes. We saw a bit of most of the brands in the top 10 were coming under a bit of pressure. I imagine that is, you know, as a country, we came into this year already in recession. And of course, pandemic has just made it markedly tougher for brands.
No, for sure. I think that's something pointed out in the webinar we had yesterday as well, that this data for this ranking is still derived from data from last year. But mm-hmm. also what they did share is anticipated impact of COVID. You know, for example, they expect that the top 50 brands in the country could lose up to 15% of their brand value as a result of COVID. So the impact is big. If you look at Minister of Finance, just in budget speech recently, he indicated in February, when we had the first budget speech, we expected global growth at 3.3%. By June, it's a contraction of 5.5%. So the impact is massive.
And some of them, I mean, one of the points with brands is growing them, nurturing them, protecting them. I mean, MTN, for example, about 5 years ago, they had their issues in Nigeria. Now they've got allegations of bribes to militant Islamist groups in Afghanistan. Does that impact reflect on a brand? Does that take some of the shine and the value off it?
I think those kind of things may have an impact, but not in the big picture. You know, I think an MTN brand or even an Old Mutual, you know, I think something we can zoom in on is an Old Mutual. Of all the top 10 brands this year, they make a 15% value increase between 2019 and 2020, the biggest growing brand in the country. So that's quite phenomenal. To your point on MTN, those incidents do impact, but ultimately the bottom line value of the brand is very difficult to effect, you know, to impact. So I think it's managed very well from an MTN side. You know, we follow quite closely the experience in Nigeria, and I do think beyond the headlines, I do think MTN is very solid in the market, you know, and South Africa as well. So it's an interesting thing, you know, ultimately perception versus the actual brand value and impact in a market.
That's a great point, because as an MTN customer, yeah, make no mistake, maybe I do care about what's happening in Afghanistan, but truthfully, I care about my engagement with the brand. I care about the quality of my network, probably a lot more.
Yes, exactly, exactly. That kind of, and actually, the CEO of MTN shared a message with us yesterday at the web during the webinar with Brand Finance, where he indicates very clearly how the brand is ultimately the glue that holds the company together on the inside. You know, we must always remember that a brand is not just an outward-facing thing; it's also to mobilize, in a way, to use an expression, to mobilize your forces on the inside to deliver on that promise. And I think in this period of COVID and the kind of risks that we are facing as a country and as brands, that dimension will become increasingly important, and how responsive we are to changing environments and changing customer need and experience.
One thing that struck out at me, biggest mover in the top 50, Life Healthcare, the listed healthcare stock, that brand value up 29%, yet Mediclinic and Netcare both down, 15 and 50% respectively. Intuitively, I would have thought sectors move in sync, but truthfully, no, there is going to be individual, as you go back to those experiences that we've had, those touch points with the brands.
Yes, no, for sure. And I do think this also illustrates, to link with what you say, the fact that a brand is a living entity out there, in a way, not always under your control. Mm-hmm. Yes, there may be real economic circumstance. Yes, there may be real events that impact on a company or its reputation or its ability to deliver. However, when it comes to the broader picture, you know, there are sometimes some interesting surprises, like you indicate that one. You know, that speaks to a brand that's much bigger, you know, sometimes than what we think it is.
You mentioned you went into some sectors. My sense is certainly under a pandemic, brands, some of them are going to have to tread a little more carefully. We've got Santam under pressure for not paying out claims in the tourism hospitality industry. But from what you're saying a moment ago, that's probably not, you know, it might take a bit of a dent off them, but it's going to be how the brands engage and respond to their customers, those touch points during a lockdown.
You know what, maybe I can raise another example to link with what you said that we discussed in our webinar today, yesterday, is the issue of SAA. Very interesting. Somebody actually asked the question,
yes,
why does SAA keep on featuring as one of South Africa's top brands while we know the company has been experiencing a tremendous amount of challenges? You know, that's where, regardless of the company experience, people still have affinity with the brand. There's still an emotional connection with the idea of South African Airways, and there's a pride in that. And that's why I think we do see, it may seem counterintuitive, while the company is going through tremendous turmoil, you see that the brand, the picture, the image, the idea of the company out there still actually carries a lot of equity. So this really drives the point home on, a company is a company. Yes, it's based on a particular industry and capability, but the image of the company, the brand out there, is also an entity in and of itself that has its own life in perception and in the mindset of people. So it's an interesting domain to move in.
That's a great example. I've flown SAA for 20 years, probably did 800 flights. And for me, it was about the experience. It was about the lounges. It was about being on time. It was about clean airplanes. And I knew all the bailouts, but I carried on flying with it because I liked the experience. Dr. Petrus de Kock, General Manager for Research at Brand South Africa, really appreciate your insights.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
That's it for today. You'll find the podcast every morning from 7 a.m. at moneyweb.co.za and the MoneyWeb app, or wherever good podcasts are aggregated. Chat to us on social media. Use the hashtag MoneyWebNow. This show was proudly sponsored by FMI, a division of Bidvest Life Limited. Make your impact, protect your income first. The views and opinions expressed in this show do not reflect the views and opinions of FMI. A massive thanks to my team, Eddie and Cordora, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.